Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. As you're aware, the focus of my show is to bring individuals to the show that are really making a difference in our world. And most certainly in these trying and challenging times that we've had during the pandemic and in the midst of the change that we are witnessing, I think it's very imperative that we have the guidance of individuals such as my upcoming guest here who can shed some light on what we can do to help ourselves. My guest today is Dr. Gail Parker. She is a psychologist. She is an author, an educator, and a certified yoga instructor. And she is also the president of the Black Yoga Foundation. The Black Yoga Teachers Foundation. Is that correct?
Teachers
or Alliance. And I think that what is so important is there are mindful ways, there are physical ways that we can help to mitigate the stress that we have, and that's going to be the topic of our discussion today. Dr. Gail has two books that work in conjunction with one another, the first having come out in August of 2020 that is entitled Restorative Yoga for Ethnic and Race-Based Stress and Trauma. And that was followed in just this month in November with a workbook that is entitled Transforming Ethnic and Race-Based Trauma Stress with Yoga. So welcome to the show, Dr. Gail.
Thank you, Elaine. It's wonderful to see you again and to be here.
Thank you. I had the great pleasure of meeting Dr. Gail briefly when we were both guests on a mindfulness episode on the Ask Dr. Nandy show. And so I had the pleasure of listening to her speak and the eloquence with which she lives her life and demonstrates how we can help ourselves. So would you please give us a little background about yourself in how it is that you became interested in yoga and how it has helped you personally before we get into how you've developed these ways of helping others?
I first was introduced to yoga in 1968 in Detroit, where there were no yoga studios, no such thing as yoga classes, no yoga teachers to be found. And there was a class being offered at the Detroit Institute of Arts that I stumbled upon. I didn't know. I must have been in the Art Institute and saw it and thought, ooh, that would be interesting. I was about 22 years old. And it was right after the Detroit riots. And so the city was traumatized at the time. I happened, as it also turns out to be at that time, involved in a physically abusive marriage. But like many people who find themselves in that situation, I was denying it. I wasn't admitting it. I wasn't telling the truth. I was doing everything but leave the relationship. I was being nice as I could be. I was being as angry as I could be. I was doing everything but leave. At any rate, I stumbled on this class, and the sense of peace and calm that I felt after having taken the class was just almost overwhelming. And I kept going back. The class was offered weekly. I went every week faithfully. And then in between classes, we would practice the yoga postures that the teacher taught us. Now, there were no such things as yoga mats then, no such things as Lululemon outfits then. We wore our street clothes and practiced on the floor, the marble floor in the DIA.
Yes, I know it well.
but it was such a peaceful experience. I later found out many, 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 many years later that the man who was teaching the class, whose name was Mr. Black, and Mr. Black wore a black suit and tie to teach us yoga. So clearly we were not doing acrobatic yoga, not the physical kind that we do today. He was a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, who wrote the Autobiography of a Yogi. And I realized I was introduced to the practice by a master.
Yes.
And that makes a difference. And I think it's why I stayed with it all of these years until yoga studios began to proliferate. I would practice at home. I would read books to see what the picture, the postures looked like. And then I would repeat those postures. That would be my practice. In the 90s, yoga studios began to proliferate. And I was the first one in the class, I'm sure. And I loved every minute of studio yoga. And I was doing a very active yoga practice. Was it 2000? Forgive me for not remembering the exact date. 9/11.
I think it was
2000 or 2001. Yeah. 2001. I was taking a yoga teacher training because I wanted to learn more about what I was practicing because I could feel the impact. And oh, by the way, I ended up getting divorced about a year after I started taking that original yoga class. All of a sudden it occurred to me, I don't have to be here. I don't have to put up with this.
Yes.
And so it was transformative. I didn't attribute that to yoga at the time. But as I look back, I realize that was really the game changer for me. When you have a sense of inner peace, when you feel that peacefulness and contrast it with the life you're living, in my world, peace won out. And I chose that instead of continuing to stay in this relationship. So now it's 9/11. We're all in trauma again.
Yes.
I happened to be in a yoga teacher training at the time, and I was introduced to restorative yoga in that training. And we can talk a little bit about that later, but it's a particular form of yoga that doesn't require muscle strength or stretching. We use props, pillows, blankets, bolsters, all kinds of things to keep the body comfortable so you can hold the postures for long periods of time so you can go into deep relaxation. That's restorative yoga. And I realized as a psychologist, which is my profession, I thought this is a beautiful practice to introduce people without me having to talk to them about it, to the fact that they have an inner life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that inner life is reflected is reflected externally. So that when you come into this place of deep peace, it's really what you want, and you begin to manifest that.
Yes.
More and more and more. So I thought this was a great compliment to my work as a psychologist. I didn't teach yoga, and I'm not a certified yoga teacher. I am, but the credential that you were referencing in the introduction is I'm a certified yoga therapist.
Oh, excuse me.
Because yoga can be used as a therapeutic intervention.
Yes.
And what I say is that all yoga can be therapeutic, but not all yoga is yoga therapy. So yoga therapy is a very specific intervention that utilizes not only yoga postures, but breath, meditation, and the philosophical precepts of yoga to support people in coming into that state of well-being.
I think that's fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Gale, because what I think is so important is most people don't realize that yoga is a way of life. It is not what has been more recently, in more modern terms, a way of exercising. It
right.
is not, you know, who has the nicest Lululemon outfit on. You know, it's not about that. It's about understanding, as you mentioned beautifully, it's about the internal landscape, so that we can actually learn how to live beautifully with life, not against life.
And we also learn how to tolerate the discomfort that we experience that comes along with life.
Yes.
So that you, I don't want to be misleading. You learn to sit in the discomfort before you take action, so that whatever action you take can come from that place of peace and clarity. instead of, you know, the reaction that the impulse that we want to act, but we're not in a place of peacefulness. So therefore, you can't elevate a situation
right
to a higher level when you yourself are in reactivity.
Yes, and I think that what people fail to see at sometimes is that the way that they emote, think, act, makes them uncomfortable, that eventually becomes a physical discomfort. And we are all one being.
Mm-hmm.
And that everything is driven by our understanding or lack of understanding of our emotions and what they are telling us and what we can do.
And I think the lack of understanding also that emotions are fleeting, they're not stable. And therefore, to act on emotion is not always a wise thing to do.
Right.
You know, and what I tell my psychotherapy clients is wait until the feeling passes. And if it still seems like a good idea to take whatever action you thought you were going to take, go for it. But then more often than not, people realize, you know what, I'm so glad I didn't act on that. I'm so glad I didn't say that. And then it doesn't mean that you don't take action. It means that you wait for the wisdom of wise action to surface before you take the action.
Yes.
Sometimes that takes a while. It doesn't happen. It's quickly necessarily.
Yes. And sometimes we know that no action is needed at all. But sometimes we have to let it be, let things be.
Right. And I think that's a way of better explaining what I meant when I said, when you are engaged in a restorative yoga practice, for example, there are lots of ways to do this, but I'm talking about restorative yoga, where it's practiced in stillness, it's practiced in silence. You learn to be still in the face of your discomfort. And what you begin to notice is it passes. It does.
Yes.
It does. That's an important lesson. You also learn to be still. When people are under stress, when people have been traumatized, when people are chronically stressed, meaning they're stressed all the time, and it's not even part of their awareness anymore. It's you just adapt to being stressed, which I would say many would probably describe most of us these days.
Yes.
When you are stressed like that, you feel safe in that stressed out space, energy. You don't feel safe being still. You don't feel safe being peaceful. You don't feel safe being quiet. And so that's another part of the learning. You learn to have an experience of safety in stillness. Safety in quiet, safety in not being reactive. It's powerful.
Yes. So that brings us to the topic of both of your books, as it relates particularly to ethnic and race-based stressful situations and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that? Obviously, there's, you know, it's unfortunately everywhere. We see the stressors that have been systematically put in place and systematically upheld, and by religions, by cultural belief systems that have nothing to do with workability, that have nothing to do with life, and have everything to do with control. So speak about that, and if you would, please, and how you've discovered that regardless of our ethnicity, we have, as women and men, for instance, we've experienced those stressors. But then when we bring in the cultural beliefs of differences, perceived differences of races, how can we begin to mitigate that challenge?
Well, those are
many questions.
So let me go to the first one, which is how did I come to this?
Yes.
Race-based traumatic, well, I've lived it for one thing, you know, it's a lived experience. So race-based stress is traumatic. It's stress that's the result of emotional injury, and a race-related emotional injury. is stressful and it can be traumatic. And it's different from post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, for those people who might be familiar with that term, PTSD.
Yes.
Which I think is, you know, I think it's interesting because I think we all just sort of casually talk about I have PTSD. We kind of claim it, but race-based traumatic stress is different. It's ongoing, it's recurrent, and it's cumulative. It's not the result of one event that has occurred that has traumatized you, which is typically a real diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder is regarded as a psychiatric disorder. There's something wrong.
Yes.
That you haven't been able to process and recover from the trauma that you experienced in the past.
Yes.
Because of a life-threatening event. That's typically what, you know, causes post-traumatic stress disorder. Race-based traumatic stress injury, on the other hand, is regarded as an emotional injury, not a life threat necessarily, although it can be, an emotional injury that is, as I said before, ongoing, recurrent, and cumulative. So it's not a one-time event. And it's also considered people's responses to race-related events is not regarded as a disorder. It's regarded as a, excuse me, a natural response.
Yes.
To an injury, to an emotional injury.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is so interesting is the emotional injury, the emotional pain that you feel when you get your feelings hurt, when your heart gets broken, for example. It's just as painful as a physical injury. In fact, it's experienced physically. You might get a stomach ache. You might have real heartache. You might get a headache. So if you're paying attention to your stress and your traumas, there's always a physical component. The reason for that is because the brain and the emotional system share the same neural pathways. And so it's you actually feel the physical pain. So you're not making it up.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think is critically important about race-based traumatic stress is that people aren't, there's nothing wrong with the person. There is something wrong, but it's not with the person, the individual. The individual has been hurt and they feel it. And what makes it worse is when people gaslight and say, that didn't really happen. Or no, this has nothing to do with race, when it's clear to everybody that it has everything to do with that. There's no other difference here but except that, for example.
Right. And
so this was a topic when I first wrote this book and was invited to write the book, by the way. This was a topic that was not being talked about at all. Not in behavioral health, not in the yoga world, not generally. And I thought it's time for me to introduce this topic and to teach people how to manage the emotional discomfort of entering into this conversation with grace and with the ability to tolerate the discomfort long enough to stay in the conversation. Because I think, I know that it's not just Black and brown people who are negatively impacted by race-based traumatic stress. White people who are terrified of Black people, who are unaware or avoid interacting with Black folks, who can't even have the conversation without being defensive, that's a sign, a symptom to me of the trauma that white people experience around issues of race and ethnicity. So I'm including everybody in this.
Yes.
And
I think also those individuals that might make the presumption that because someone is white that they're prejudiced. And they may not be at all. They may not be. They may be trying to be more open and aware of everything and everyone.
But when you're filtering everything through a racial lens,
yes,
then you experience this as you experience it on a deep level of identity.
Yes.
Because we all have a cultural, ethnic, racial, national, gender identity. We have multiple identities here.
Yes.
And so we're talking about deep levels of experience, not skin color.
Right.
It gets reduced to skin color. Mm-hmm. And it isn't about skin color. Well, in the United States, it is, because at skin color, you know, there's a skin color hierarchy in the United States and probably worldwide. But we're talking about deep, deep, deep issues associated with who am I? How do I identify myself?
Yes.
You know, and as far as prejudice is concerned, every single one of us has prejudices and biases. Those are our preferences and our aversions, the things we don't like and the things that we're attracted to. That's
right.
What a bias is. That's what, and when we prejudge, we're making assumptions and assumptions and judgments about people without even knowing who they are.
Yes.
And that's, you know, you mentioned that we met on a show associated with mindfulness. And that's what a mindfulness practice helps us do. It helps us suspend judgment. It helps us avoid those interpretations that we carry within our consciousness that we may not even be aware of. Mindfulness supports us in maintaining our sense of our own identity while we can empathize with somebody else's.
Yes.
So these are practices, and this is what the restorative practice does also. It supports mindfulness, mm-hmm. awareness. I always say that awareness is the medicine of healing.
Absolutely.
But awareness can sometimes be hard to digest, can't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially when we see our own errors of thinking.
Exactly.
When we see how we've contributed to harm.
Yeah.
Maybe unknowingly or worse, knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have an opportunity, I think, to begin to understand that when we close our eyes and we attempt to be in the state of total awareness, we recognize that first and foremost, we're human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We did not, in our knowingness, choose where we were born, when we were born, mm-hmm. to whom we were born. But we have an opportunity to begin to learn how to appreciate this gift called life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I think in what I'm teaching and supporting, and this is hard for people to get, it's still me trying to invite people to go inside. And instead of trying to fix the other person. No, it begins with me.
Yes.
I have to do my inner work. I have to understand, where am I coming from? Why do I have this preference? Why do I have this aversion? Where did I learn that? Does it make sense? Is it harmful? Am I being harmful to other people? These are the questions that we begin to ask ourselves, and we want to answer them honestly.
Yes.
And sometimes it's hard to be honest with yourself.
Yes.
Which is why we need other people to hold up mirrors for us.
And yes, sometimes, indeed.
And sometimes we don't like the mirror that's being held up for us. So.
Mm-hmm. So please help us to understand what you've discovered. Obviously, you've mentioned in your own immersion in yoga at a very particular time, very volatile time in the city of Detroit. I remember it well. And how have you found that bringing that and introducing that to people now, we're in a different, not identical level of stress that was experienced in the late 60s, but it is still the same. This trauma that we're experiencing, this divide that we have to somehow learn how to bridge.
Well, again, I think that I think you have to do the inner work as well. I think that we are a culture embedded in unhealed trauma.
Yes.
This is a culture that says, put the past behind you and move on. We don't want to look back. We don't want to talk about this. We want to erase the painful aspects of our reality nationally, interpersonally, and intrapersonally, within myself personally. This is a sign of trauma. When you are in denial, remember when I said I was in this abusive relationship?
Yes.
And if you had asked me at the time, was it a traumatic experience? I probably would have said, no, you know, I didn't like it. But I don't know that I would have called it trauma, but of course it's traumatic to be in that kind of a situation. I was in denial. I knew I was in the situation, but I wasn't going to admit it to anybody. Hmm. And it wasn't until that inner mirror showed itself to me when it said, you know, he's crazy, but so are you, because you're putting up with this. And those were the exact words that came to me in that moment. Hmm. And in that instant, I realized, oh, and I can do something about me.
Yes. Never can you do anything about someone else's choice.
Never.
Never.
Never, ever, ever. And so I think that that's how we deal with issues of race-related stress and trauma. We have to deal with me. Yes. Who am I? What is my racial identity? How do I identify racially? What is my relationship to my own racial identity? This is for everybody. This is not just for Black folks. What is my relationship to other members of my race? What is my relationship to members who are of different races? And to really be willing to go deep into that exploration and examination and not be defensive and not jump to, but we're all human. But we don't start there. Well, you can start there, but you don't stay. You know what I mean? It's like you want to drill down into that.
Yes.
We are human first. We are. And ultimately, that is the awareness that we want people to experience, not the words, not just the words to say, but the deep internalized awareness and the experience of recognizing, oh, I'm nothing but you. Well, we don't start there.
Right.
We start with, here's psychology 101, simplified. Identity development. We start with, I'm not you. Now, and two-year-olds start that. Before a child begins to separate out from the parent emotionally, there's symbiosis. There's no difference between. That's interesting. I guess we end up the way we start. There's no difference between you and me when I'm an infant.
Yes, isn't that true?
There comes a point when the next phase is, I'm not you. I'm not you. I don't know who I am yet, but I know I'm not you. And that's where you get all the pushback and the no and the this. And by the way, we're seeing some of that being acted out right now, aren't we?
Yes, we certainly are.
So it's infantile. I mean, it's very immature to be stuck in I'm not you when you're 50.
Yes.
So, but many of us have been and are, and I'm not saying that I wasn't, but I'm not you. Around adolescence, people begin to develop a sense of, I'm somewhat like you. Now we can begin to cultivate that place of empathy. I'm somewhat like you. And eventually we get to, I'm nothing but you. I'm nothing but you. But that's a long journey. That doesn't happen right away. That's a lifetime. A lifetime to really get to that place. And as I said, so we end up the way we start. Mm-hmm. I think a beginning, a middle, and an end. But that takes deep. This takes deep inner work. It does.
Yes. And the desire to step out of our belief systems.
Exactly.
The desire to say, you know, I think that in this global pandemic, there's been many pearls of wisdom that have been given to us. That we see, yes, we are indeed connected. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are indeed a global society. Yes, we are indeed dependent upon one another. We're dependent upon the beauty of the earth, the abundance of the earth, from which we gain our sustenance, and that we have to learn either kicking and screaming or openly in dialogue with how do we disassemble, how do we take away these beliefs that have caused so much harm?
And if we can't take the beliefs away, I think one of the places we can certainly start is just because I've thought it or doesn't mean I have to believe it.
Right.
And just because I believe it doesn't mean it's true.
That's right.
And so, again, these are very subtle but important abilities, mindfulness, to realize the difference between a belief, an opinion, and a fact, an actual thing that's occurring in front of you.
Yes.
And it sounds kind of obvious, but it's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
Right.
I want to talk about a little bit about this global awakening to our shared humanity. But here's something else that I found out when I was researching the second book, which is really about how to transform, how to move from post-traumatic stress or traumatic stress injury to growth, because it's possible to grow through trauma. That historically, whenever there is a global pandemic, a disease outbreak, there is an increase in racism and xenophobia. And so that's what we're seeing now.
Yes, we are.
Why? People are now in survival mode. They're no longer focused on thinking with clarity. Fear is now controlling what's going on.
Yes.
And
when we recognize, again, my guest is Dr. Gail Parker, and she is the author of two wonderful books. One is the workbook associated with the understanding and the continuing education of her first book, which was Restorative Yoga for Ethnic and Race-Based Stress and Trauma. The second being called Transforming, I have to put my glasses back on, my apologies, Transforming Ethnic and Race-Based Traumatic Stress with Yoga. So, and it's beautiful that it came out in this time.
Well, I had nothing to do with that. Yeah, it's true. It was
so necessary.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to say is what we don't realize is that belief can absolutely stop thinking. That if we espouse a belief, we no longer have to think of the ramifications of what we assume we believe, what we assume to be true, that we just react rather than respond. And we lose that capacity to really learn why we're even here to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important.
And I would say that our minds tend to close and contract around belief. You know, we like our beliefs. We're very connected to our belief system. And the thought of disconnecting from a belief system is scary. It's easier said than done, put it that way.
Yes.
Why would I want to? Why would I want to give up my beliefs? Might be, you know, it's a good question. Mm-hmm. But that, if somebody's thinking that, by the way, that's a good question to take into a meditation. It's a good question. Why would I want to? Maybe I don't want to. I don't know. And so, but just the willingness to just even examine my thought or my belief or my preference or my aversion. It's about approaching oneself with curiosity and with compassion, not with shame, not with blame, not with criticism, but with a compassionate awareness, you know, that we are human.
Yes. You know, and you probably are very well aware of this, the late Dr. Felicitas Goodman, who studied for many, many years what were referred to as ecstatic trance postures, and understood that when we get into particular positions physically, it does something to the alignment of the energy within our body that connects us in ways that open us to dimensions that are internal and external, but all one. And then, of course, the most recently, Dr. Sadhguru, who has worked around the world to help people understand that when we begin to tap into this internal part of ourselves, we have never really, in our known history, understood our enormous potential, our enormous capacity for intellect and for compassion and for inclusion and workability. And I think, and I applaud you for the work that you do and the beautiful way in which you articulate this difficult subject, but important subject.
Yes. And my hope is that people who are interested, because everyone is not interested in this, but that the people who are interested in this aspect of self-discovery learn to be, again, compassionate with self, understanding of self, curious about oneself, and to create, I don't know, just, again, to bring to this conversation the ability to just enter into conversation and not, there was something, you know how some people will say, well, let's just agree to disagree.
Yes.
That's a closed mind.
Yes, it is.
That's something someone contracted around a belief that they are not willing to examine, you know, that ends the conversation. So I want to support us in moving beyond that, moving beyond the need for agreement to building a bridge toward understanding.
Yes. There's a term called courageous conversations, and I think we have to have those courageous conversations with ourselves, beginning with ourselves.
And then we can begin to do that with each other.
Yes. And you have certainly been on national and international stages. Many times you've been on the Oprah Show. And tell me how you have found that others now are reaching out to you because of this, I think, this time that we're in, especially with this global pandemic. I think there are far more people, I believe, that want to make meaningful change. But we hear from so many who don't. And we hear we hear the noise. That doesn't mean that they're the majority. It just means they're the one who get the most attention. But how are you finding that people are approaching you and what they want to do to begin to integrate this more into our world?
Well, fortunately for me, because I have written these books, people are buying the books. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And they're learning from the books. And then I am invited to come on someone's podcast. Thank you, Elaine.
My pleasure.
I'm invited to offer, various webinars and workshops. And I select who I'm willing to do that work with.
Yes.
And that's really how it goes. I mean,
and how are you seeing that people are transforming? I recognize that when you can be more at peace within yourself and not necessarily trying to push that on anyone else, but people then have a genuine, I believe, curiosity of like, what are you doing? Why? How is it you can be happy in spite of having a challenge, a big challenge? Or how is it that I think that the greatest thing, change agent is when someone sees someone's joy.
I'm just reminded of a story that I like to tell.
Please.
I was about 35 years old, and my mother's oldest sister, who absolutely adored me, I could do no wrong. It didn't matter what I said or did or didn't say or didn't. She loved me unconditionally. It's an amazing experience, and I'm blessed to have had it. But she was a very negative person, but she was funny negative, but she was really negative. And one day we were talking and she said, "Tell me something, honey, how come you're not bitter?" I said, "Bitter? What? Why would I be bitter?" So she articulated all of the reasons I had to be bitter. And all of those reasons were, in fact, things that had occurred. And I thought about it for a minute and I looked at her and I said, "Because I can't stand the way it feels." Mm-hmm. I can't stand the way it feels. And so I can't stay there for any length of time. Now, I think that that might be a gift, that I just don't like feeling like that. And at the bottom of all of that anyway is this unbounded joy that I think really is the essence of who we all are. And I think to the extent that you set a goal, it's to tap into that energy, that joyful energy, that peaceful energy, that place that gives you solace. And that's what I do. And so I do these practices. You know, I meditate regularly. My yoga practice is becoming more less athletic and more contemplative. And I live a life that allows me to stay connected with that part of my being. I like it a lot. And so that has become my default mode.
That's a great default.
Yeah.
And I think that
it can become anybody's if you do the practice, if you do the work, if you stick with it, because it's natural. See, this is natural.
Is. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we have really terribly been misled in is that we do not understand that our emotions are providing us information. Mm-hmm. How we feel. Is this good for me? Is this not good for me? Mm-hmm. And we've never been taught to honor what we're viscerally feeling, how we're emoting, and what that is telling us. Mm-hmm. We've been entrained to disavow our emotions, especially as women, to override them. Oh, I have to be the good girl, or I have to be the good mama, or the good wife, or whatever. And we work against ourselves without realizing the damage it does. Emotionally, physically, mm-hmm. mentally.
Mm-hmm. And so one good question to ask yourself when something comes up, whether it's something that is pleasurable or something that is unpleasant, ask yourself, what is my bodily sensation right now? What is my body experiencing right now? And that will give you some clues about the energy, you know, the energy that you are experiencing. Absolutely. Around an event. Yeah.
Right. Right. As an
we
energy.
We tend to ask it, what am I thinking? What is my body telling
Your
me?
Your body is always the accurate mm-hmm. decipher or the accurate receiver, I should say. Mm-hmm. We attempt to decipher in our quote unquote known language.
Yes.
And as an energy healer myself, I've been doing this 25 years. That is the thing that I find every day, that people don't comprehend the enormity of the information their emotions are providing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
I was just thinking, I was talking to a friend about some dilemma. You know, I don't know if I do this, should I do that, blah, 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 blah. She's also an energy healer. She said, what's your felt sense? What's your body telling you? It was amazing. Well, of course, you know what your body's telling you. And it was, no, I don't want to do it. But I didn't like that answer. See, that's the other thing. We may not always like the answer.
True.
That our body gives us, or that higher self gives us. Now, what do you do? Yes. Now I've got the answer, which you've always had the answer, by the way. Now, what do I do? Do I honor the answer, or do I do what I wanted to do? So, yeah.
Yes. So again, my guest is Dr. Gail Parker. Dr. Parker, how is the best way for people to reach out to you? Do you have a website that we can let people know about, please?
I do. It's very simple. It's drgailparker.com, GAIL Parker.com.
Okay. And where are your books available, and what is the best way for individuals to get your book?
So your books can either order from Amazon, or you can go to my website and click on the covers of the books in the website and order them there.
Okay. Are they available in physical books, ebooks, audiobooks? How are they available?
Yes. Yeah. The first book is Kindle, paperback, and audio. The second book is paperback and Kindle.
Okay. So your website is Dr. Gail Parker. Mm-hmm. Dr. Okay.
D-R-D-L
I just want to see, because it's on the screen incorrectly, I just want to make sure that that gets corrected. It's drgailparker.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so this is what it looks like on the website if you want to order.
Great.
Hit the button.
Great. Now, you had mentioned that how are other people, or I should say, I had a thought, how are other people coming to learn from your specific way of understanding how do we mitigate stress, whether that is someone who is, if we can attempt to extrapolate and take away race particularly,
yeah,
but let's say women who have been traumatized regardless of their gender or of their ethnicity, how do we begin to, I'm sure that there's many people that are saying, well, I may not be an African-American, may not be a Black individual, but I still have this trauma.
Exactly. So these books, I'm glad you brought this up, because my particular area of interest was dealing with racial trauma because nobody's talking about it. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a thing. It's a thing. All right.
Yes.
However, you don't have to know anything about yoga. You don't have to know anything about race and ethnicity to benefit from these books, because they were written, again, keeping in mind and knowing that, you know, we're all human here and all of us have had some experience with stress and trauma. This just happens to be the particular topic that I'm talking about right now, but you don't have to have had a direct experience of racial trauma, for example, to benefit from reading this book and doing the practices. My choice, my go-to is restorative yoga. Restorative yoga, as I described to you before, it's a receptive form of yoga. It's not an active form of yoga. And the entire time you're doing the practice, you're stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of your nervous system that slows everything down. So when you're under stress and on high alert, whether you know it or not, you're out of balance. When you bring, that's the sympathetic nervous system, is the part that causes us to move.
Yes.
The fight or flight.
Where we're flooded with adrenaline and we react. We don't respond.
The rest and digest system, the parasympathetic nervous system, floods us with oxytocin, you know, and calms us. So when both our parasympathetic and sympathetic nerve, when our fight and flight, when our rest and digest systems are in balance, that's the optimal state we want to find ourselves in. It's not one or the other. We want them in balance. And so when you do, so I figure people who are on high alert most of the time need to practice being still, need to practice being quiet, need to practice beginning to feel that sense of safety in stillness and quiet, that sense of peacefulness. When the relaxation response clicks in, which is what we're trying to stimulate in this practice, blood pressure drops, metabolism slows, breathing becomes more efficient, brain waves slow down, and heart rate slows. Those are real physiologic reactions and responses to relaxation. So yes, that's why I say that these are practices that support health and growth and resilience.
And also, I would imagine, has a cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
The body then can use that vital energy to repair.
Exactly. That's what's happening.
Yes, to repair the damage, to begin to mitigate or give the body the ability to correct an injury, mm-hmm. to heal an injury, to mitigate pain. to allow something to literally be healed and possibly cured, no longer there.
Because health, just like that sense of joyfulness, is our natural state of being.
Yes.
And when we give ourselves the conditions that support health and well-being, the body responds immediately. It does.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've had the privilege over the years of working with people in medicine. And they themselves are terribly stressed because the world in which they thought they were entering of compassion and caring has greatly changed to the money-driven, unfortunately, redirected to the culture of the particular institution that might be in competition with another institution. Mm-hmm. And so we have an opportunity to really look at what is causing us the harm so that we can begin to step back from it and recognize it, as you said, to begin to look at and question what is the many, many, many things that we believe, not just one singular thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how do we unwind ourselves from those things?
Exactly.
To be more collaborative.
Mm-hmm. And so that means coming, for the most, very simply, out of your head and into your heart.
Yes. Yes.
How do I occupy my heart space? How do I? Because again, we're out of balance. You know, we're out of balance. We think that thought is king or queen. It's not. Thought is thought.
Right.
But not all thoughts are worth thinking about, as you know.
I mean, yes.
And that's part of what happened for new meditators. When you sit to meditate at first, and even for older ones, really, me included, you know, you have all these thoughts. Oh, my gosh. And your mind is just racing. Until it gets the message that I'm not going to think about you right now. You know, you have these thoughts, but you don't have to think about the thoughts. Right now, I'm just paying attention to my breathing, for example. I'm just paying attention to my breath. I'm not thinking about you right now. And when you notice that you're thinking about the thought, you bring it back to, let me just bring it back to my breath. And so one of the things I teach people is that a meditative mind is not a quiet mind. It's an aware mind.
Yes.
A meditative mind is an aware mind.
Mm-hmm. So, very, very important for people to have that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Because and we don't have to sit and om for hours, as many people think. Well, I don't have time to meditate. Well, in truth, you're meditating, you're thinking, you're being present in life constantly.
That's
how
right.
do you choose to be present with
mm-hmm.
life?
Mm-hmm.
Aware of what you're thinking and how you're responding. Or not responding, simply reacting.
Mm-hmm. And I say that we all have 20 minutes a day that we can devote to being still and quiet and reflective. Everybody has 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And if you don't, if 20 minutes is too long to start with 5 and build up to 20.
Yeah. Yes. Because that amazingly, when you're in that moment, 5 minutes can feel like an hour.
Oh my gosh. And sometimes, and when you go deep enough into the meditation, sometimes 20 minutes, a half an hour feels like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yes.
It's an amazing.
Because we have such, we have beliefs about time.
Mm-hmm.
We have beliefs about our internal part of ourselves that we have yet to really discover. But when we do, it's truly magical.
Yeah.
In the most beautiful way.
Yeah.
Not magical in the elusive way,
mm-hmm.
but magical in that brings us closer to the awareness of ourselves. So again, we're just winding down to the last 2 minutes, and it always seems to go by quickly. So any last words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom, Dr. Gale, that you can share and offer? They're valuable.
I should have a ready-made list of those. The one that's coming to my mind right now, the one that I share with people often, is I think it's important to learn to be still. And the way I would say it is, don't just do something. Sit there. Don't just do something, sit there. And we've all been doing that for almost 2 years now, haven't we?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that makes a difference. What difference it makes, we don't know exactly. But just remember, you don't have to act on every thought you have or every feeling that you have.
Yes.
Sit still. Wait until you feel peaceful. And then decide what action you're going to take. That may take some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting because medical professionals understand that. When people come into an emergency situation, they don't speed up. They slow down.
Yes.
They slow down to get really clear and focused about what they're doing. So we can all learn from that.
Wow. Please, I would encourage all of my listeners to please go to Dr. Gail Parker's website, which is www.drgailparker.com. And I would encourage you to scroll through her beautiful website and encourage you to get her books, to begin to see that internal landscape that is available to us all, and see what you can do to help to bring yourself to a place of peace so that we can actually, when we learn how to be peaceful, we will be enormously creative. When we can get away from the challenges that we have believed are normal, we have no idea yet what our capacity is as human beings, but we certainly need to discover it. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Parker. I really appreciate it. And I hope you are able to spread this information around the world, because I think that we need it to get back to ourselves.
Thank you, Elaine. Thanks for having me on.
This is Elaine Groman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. You too can make a difference, no matter where you are, in your home, in the boardroom, in your office, taking a walk. Your life is important, and together we can make a difference. Thank you.